Here is Dr. Walter Bradley, and he's a distinguished professor here at Baylor.
I'm going to talk today about cook stoves, but I'm not going to talk just about cook stoves. Elisa Teipel, who is a student who worked with me on this project, was going to make a more detailed presentation just about that, but has had some emergencies that prevented her from being able to be here today. And so I'm going to share a bit about her project, but I want to share about two others. And then I want to help you to think about if you were interested in getting involved in this kind of work, how would you get started? Because 4 years ago, when I first started trying to think about, I want to do appropriate technology, I'd like to use my engineering gifts and talents and training and experience to do that, the question is, what would I do? And that seems like a pretty vexing question, but I have found over the past 4 years, I now have a lot more ideas and a lot more partners than I have time. And I think Brian would agree, we were sort of starting at about the same time getting going on this. And initially, you kind of wonder where to put your oar in the water, and after a while, you feel like your boat's being swamped. You know, and actually, that's good. You look around the world today, there's no shortage of people that have difficult lives. Over 2.7 billion people live on $2 a day. 2 billion people cook on 3 stone fires, 3 meals a day. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? 2 billion people a day do what I did when I was getting my Eagle Scout Award, doing camping, cooking merit badges, and all this kind of stuff. But that's, for me, what I did just on a trip once in a while. It's not what I did 3 times a day. Situation is very difficult, and people have no access to electricity. As Brian was talking about, 1.6 billion people have no access to electricity. Occasionally, we have a storm, and the power goes out momentarily. We are just paralyzed. I mean, we can't do anything, you know. We just kind of have to sit and wait it out, because without electricity, there's almost none of the normal things that we do that are feasible. The biblical mandate says, Jesus speaking in one of the Gospels, Matthew 25, says, when you fed, gave water to, clothed, provided medical care, invited into your homes one of these poor brothers of mine, you did it for me. I think Jesus is very clear that we have a responsibility, not just a possibility, but a responsibility to try to care for the poor. And I think this must be Luke 12. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded, and from each one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Until recently, maybe 5 years ago or 6 years ago, I thought about that primarily in terms of writing checks to adopt orphans and to help orphanages and maybe to give to World Vision type ministries. And it hadn't fully occurred to me that what I've been given is not that much money. Okay, what I have been given is a lot of possibilities because of my engineering training, gifts, and talents. And what I've come to discover over the last 5 or 6 years is the greatest thing God entrusted me with was not a huge bank account. I wouldn't be teaching if that's what I'd been shooting for. I would have gone and worked in industry. But in fact, what he's given me is a wonderful opportunity because of the engineering background I have to be able to help poor people. Almost all the engineering services go to the most wealthy 1 billion people. Okay? And almost nobody does engineering to address the needs of the other 5 billion, and so there's a huge opportunity. One of the things I like about working in this area is everybody collaborates, everybody cooperates. There's no cutthroat competition. There's lots more poor people to go around, right? So there's a really great spirit of let's all work together and see what we can do to help, because we're not competitors, you know. There's plenty of poor people. We're not going to run out of them, according to what the Bible says. So we're doing a variety of things at Baylor. In the next talk, you're going to hear about converting coconuts into value-added products in detail, making cheap, energy-efficient, durable cook stoves, making low-cost housing, making bridges, providing electric power, using macro hydro. We've gotten involved in a whole variety of projects. But I'm going to talk, let's first talk about the stoves project. 600 million households cook with dry biomass every day in developing countries, okay? About 4 people per household, and that's probably a low estimate, puts the number of people who are in this category of eating eating food prepared on cook stoves fired by and large with wood is a huge number of people. Now, why are these cook stoves so important? Well, one of the first reasons is they are a huge hazard to people's health. Okay, the fourth leading cause of poor health in developing countries is smoke from cook stoves. Many people cook on these indoors, although even if you cooked in outdoors, it's not that healthy. But a lot of places where it's cold or where it rains, people cook indoors, and you will see houses like the one on the right here in which it is just filled with a smoke. It'd be like smoking 10 packs of cigarettes per day. So the World Health Organization says the fourth leading cause of poor health. Anybody know what the first one is? Water. Yeah, water is the biggest, okay? But so this is, how would you like it if this was your house, okay? Two children, a mom. The respiratory problems are much greater for the women and for the children because they're the ones that tend to be at home. It's also dangerous when you're cooking indoors. If you can imagine having a fire in your living room and having small children playing, it's almost inevitable that people are going to have accidents and terrible things are going to happen as a result of that. And then we have the problem of not just health and safety, but we have the problem of environmental sensitivity. If you're going to use wood-burning cook stoves, people use these because they can't afford other options. They can't afford propane. They probably can't afford charcoal. And they can go and scavenger wood for free. But the problem is, gradually, as they keep scavengering wood for free, they scavenger more and more wood, and more of the forest are burnt down. And it becomes a problem also because now they have to go over greater and greater distances to collect that wood. This is what a community might look like where everybody's cooking dinner. We went to a place when we were in South Africa, and you remember Soweto, where the whole place just turned smoky about dinner time. We were there, and it was nice, and then all of a sudden it was like, you know, being in the middle of a smokestack. This is how some people spend 5 to 6 hours a day, because they have to go and collect the wood. And sadly, it's almost always the women that get stuck with carrying the wood, carrying the water. Women's rights have not come yet to some of the places I've been, and the men often defer to them on almost all of the hard work. A lady may spend 5 or 6 hours collecting just enough wood to last for 1 or 2 days. So a tremendous amount of time. Young girls are sometimes not allowed to go to school because of that. Okay, this is a picture of Elisa, who should be giving this talk, but she's not able to be here. And this has to do with the cook stove that she actually built in the Andes mountains. And the mother and the little boy don't look that happy, but I think it reminds me of pictures from the 1800s here where people haven't had their picture taken, and they think when you're having your picture taken, you should look real serious and real solemn. You know, all the old pictures I see look like that. If I would have been her, I would have sort of punched them or something, you know, or tickled them to say, hey, smile, cheer, you know, don't you like your new snow? They look like this is the last roundup. Now, we've been working on a project with Shell Foundation. It's funded by Shell Foundation through Colorado State University. And the goal of this project is to develop an efficient, durable wood-burning cook stove for about $120 to $150. Durability for us means 5 years. Efficiency means ideally 40%, although that's probably higher than one can easily get to. Carbon credits, if you could meet these targets, carbon credits traded in Europe would allow you to get about $120 worth of income. If you could demonstrate the cook stove would produce that much increase in efficiency, would reduce through that the carbon dioxide emissions, which is where you get the carbon credits from, and would last 5 years, then they would be willing to give a credit for each stove sold over $120. So we could easily then make these stoves available almost for free. Okay. So this is a design of what the stove might look like. The rocket stove design includes a combustion chamber on the inside. The combustion chamber is L-shaped. You stick the wood in. From in the horizontal zone. The fire burns in the zone that's labeled burnout. You have a hot air draft that goes up, and then the stoves or the pots and so forth sit on top where all that very hot air is coming out and provides the cooking. Now the challenge here, the stove that we're working on, or that we've essentially finished the project on, actually burns at about 900 degrees centigrade, about 1600 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not very much lower than a jet engine, okay? But it's burning really dirty fuel. we discovered that if you burn nice wood like 2x4s from the lumber yard, it doesn't have so much problem. But if you burn bark on wood like they would be carrying, they're not going to have clean wood. They're going to have wood that's just dirty. Dirty in the sense that it has bark on it, and the bark is filled with all kinds of chemicals and compounds that tend to be highly corrosive. So in some ways, our material problems are comparable to making jet engines that burnt really, really dirty fuel. I mean, a jet engine couldn't run on bark, obviously, but or wood with bark on it. But that's basically the challenge. We need some different properties, and I think the details here aren't so important. Let me share with you the different possibilities. You can use ceramics. Ceramics are pretty good, but they have problems with thermal cycling. When you heat up and cool down, they tend to crack. Some of you know, if you took different kinds of pots in your stove, you cook something in them, you put cold water in them, and they crack if they're ceramic. So a typical ceramic would have this problem of thermal cycling, and it would tend to crack. We tried aerated concrete. That's actually a pretty cheap, inexpensive way to do it. The aerated concrete has some pretty good advantages. It also has this problem of when you heat it up and cool it down, it cracks. So it's not durable. You may say, well, there's no problem. Just use a big cast iron cook stove. Some of you have seen these old wood-burning cook stoves, and you say, that's a perfect solution. They last for a long time. Problem is, you spend a huge amount of energy heating up the stove. It's like a big, huge heat sink. And so some of the cast iron wood-burning cook stoves that we think are a great solution are not a very great solution because they're fairly expensive. But more than that, they use a huge amount of wood. And if you're out in at your little cabin burning it a few times in the winter, that's one thing. If you're cooking three times a day, it takes a long time to heat it up. It takes a tremendous amount of wood. It is simply not a good solution. So we've ended up working with some different metal alloys, very thin-walled. The way this would work is a chamber would have thin-walled metal pieces inside of a bigger ceramic that would be kind of a housing. And between the metal combustion chamber and the wall is going to be air, and the air makes a very good insulation. The wall made out of the combustion chamber made with metal will do the thermal cycling without problems. And so at this point, we think that we've come up with a solution. Our only concern is depending on what kind of wood they're burning. And if you don't, in the first burn, you need to form an oxide on the surface that would give it a protective care. And we're a little bit concerned that we can't do that by just giving them the right wood and saying, really heat it really hot the first time. If we have to do the conditioning, it runs a cost up. And so there's some engineering questions. We're going to try it without doing the preconditioning of the metal, but we'll see. Shell Foundation is interested in putting up $25 million to put up production at 6 different locations around the world in the countries where these would be used. And again, the potential impact would be as much as 2 billion people. A cook stove is a good area if you're trying to say where would be an interesting area to work on. Trust me, the cook stove problems are not all solved. And the problem is, in every country, it's a different problem. They use different kinds of wood. They have different kinds of cooking styles. Some people want to make tortillas. Some people want to cook beans slowly. Some people want to cook something that requires a shorter time at a higher temperature. So I think that's why when I first got into this, I thought, why don't they just get one good stove and be done with it? But the answer is it's not that simple, and it's a really interesting, important problem. Here's a second area that we've worked on. This used to be until recently, somebody's house in Armenia. And you say, gosh, that doesn't look like much of a house. Well, when they were living in it, it still had the roofs on. Somebody's taken the roof pieces off. That's an old shipping container off of a train. And for poor people in Armenia, they often live in metal shipping containers. Now, you need to know it gets down to minus 20 degrees below zero in the wintertime. These people cannot afford fuel. And it's often the case that particularly the children freeze to death in the wintertime because it's just too cold. And so we were trying to figure out an interesting way to try to make energy efficient but low-cost housing. Okay, so here's what we've come up with. There's a nice system. This looks like big Lego blocks, and it goes together like Lego blocks. You could build a house with a bunch of kids. It doesn't require special training. Those blocks are styrofoam. When we first said that's what we're going to do, people said, oh, don't do that. That's not environmentally friendly. And we said, look, we're not throwing them in the city dump. We want these to not be biodegradable, right? We want our house to last for 50 years, not for 6 months. So the fact that it's not biodegradable, if you're using it to make a house, is actually a plus. If you're making cups to throw away in the landfill, then it's not. Okay, you put rebar in. Turns out each of the, I can walk over here, yeah. These are about 5-inch diameter holes that go through. And, of course, they line up. There's the little recessed areas that are on the bottom to fit these. So these things go together like sort of tall Lego blocks. We put rebar in there, and then you come along and you pour concrete. We're just doing every other one. So on 16-inch centers, we have a concrete set of columns. And then the fourth one, this is 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot, the fourth one will have a horizontal beam cavity in there. And when we pour it, we end up with a concrete beam and a column construction, much like you might have with a stick-built house, poured on a concrete foundation. We can build one whole set of walls in one afternoon, okay? The total cost of the walls of this house is about $2,000, which is really, really cheap. And the labor cost is minimal. The R value, for those of you that know R values, is 30. The R value requirements for houses in the United States, most places, is 19. So this is a lot better than the insulation we have in our houses. And it's really pretty exciting to see how quickly and easily it can be built. The houses they now use in Armenia, the people who have more money build a 30-inch thick walls, 12 inches of stone, 6 inches of poured-in-place concrete, 12 inches of stone. I couldn't figure out why they were 30 inches thick until I looked at the thermal conductivities. That 30-inch thick wall has an R value of 6. And low numbers are bad, high numbers are good. So this is 5 times better than what they're building now. It's only 8 inches thick and weighs almost nothing. A normal house requires a lot more material, very expensive, difficult to build, and has an R value of only 6. So this is exciting. We built 2 summers ago a couple of houses in Armenia. This is an example of what one might look like. This is a bunch of the students that helped to build it. It's a really cute little house, and it will require a very, very low amount of energy to keep it warm in the wintertime. People say, well, who wants a house that looks like a styrofoam cup? Well, we actually, even poor people have their dignity, right? And they think it's undignified to live in a house that looks like a styrofoam cup, and it might even give the appearance of being unsafe. So we spray the outside with some kind of a plaster, and then it looks like a California contemporary, right? Sort of that stucco look if you want to sort of mess with it. Our partners in this project were Point Loma, Armenia Gospel Association, George Fermanian. One of the things we've learned is if you're going to do stuff like this, you need to work with people in country who know all the kind of problems and issues and all the government stuff. Now they have built 16 more since then, and they're bidding on a government contract. The government put out a bid for low-cost housing, $25,000 a house. They got no bidders. They can build these houses with all the necessary plumbing and wiring and the sinks and tubs and so forth for about 15. So they're getting ready to bid on building 3,500 houses in Armenia, which is very exciting. They'll be very energy efficient, inexpensive. It's going to be really cool. Okay, the last example I want to mention, this is actually a bridge that we built in Kenya. People often say, well, what's the difference between a Christian bridge and a non-Christian bridge, you know, when we talk about appropriate technology? And I say, well, it depends on where you build it and who you build it for, okay? And this is a good example of a Christian bridge. We went there because we were concerned the people on the far side of the river could not access medical care, markets, or education for their children. The women, to get to market once a week, they would walk about 20 miles to get to market carrying 30 pounds worth of produce on their heads and backs, exchange it for some other produce, and then carry that same amount of weight home. Can you imagine a 40-mile hike every Saturday in the heat carrying that much weight? So this is a bridge that we built for $5,000. It'll save about 2 million miles worth of walking per year. It'll last, we hope, at least 10 years, and the cost per mile is about a thousandth of a cent. So we think this is a good buy in transportation. All the things they need are right across this river. Now you say, well, why don't they just get across the river? It's only 140 feet wide. The answer is because the river has crocodiles and hippopotamuses. You know, when you're in Texas, you'd say, well, why don't they swim? You know, what's wrong with them? There's a neat bridge in Waco that was built in 1870. We'll come to that in a second. Here's a bridge. We were asked to help build a bridge that's across a much bigger river in Kenya. And here's the guy. Harmon is in the middle. This says, well, this doesn't look like a dangerous river, but it's really the very dry season, so the river's pretty low. Even at this time of year, notice what they're all carrying, machetes and guns, because there's still lots of crocodiles, okay? The fact that the water's low doesn't make it safe, and when the water's high, it's obviously less safe. Crocodiles and hippos in this water. They wanted to build a bridge because there was a group of Irish missionaries that took some people as part of their ministry to them as a gospel ministry that was very holistic. They taught them how to do drip irrigation. And with drip irrigation, they went from getting one crop per year and being subsistence farmers to getting three crops a year and having a big surplus. The problem was there was no way to get the food to market. The nearest place they could get food to just cross the river was like 50 miles. So it turns out the produce they had that they could sell was worth about $140,000 a year, and they were just, it was rotting. That's how much extra surplus they had. So we were able to help design this new bridge that they built, 450 feet long. It cost about $250,000. This was raised not from churches. It was raised basically from a lot of international development organizations who were very happy to have somebody who was willing to go and design it and help to build it, and they were quite happy to fund it. If you think about the return on this, it will pay it back in what it does for the farmer's income in about 1.5 years. So a great investment in helping a village that has always been subsistence with the loving care of these missionaries. Many of the people have become Christians, and they have now become much better farmers, and now they're going to begin for the first time to actually have some income to buy other things. These are just cool pictures. I wasn't the one that took this picture and wouldn't have wanted to have been. If you can picture where that's from, that's up on the top of those uprights looking down the cables, okay? And those are fairly big cables. They're 1.25-inch diameter, and that's what the bridge looks like. This is like a pedestrian version of the Golden Gate Bridge, and they made it especially narrow because they don't want people taking their cow or their horse or their donkey across there. It really is meant to be just for people. And here are some of the people in the village who will be some of the beneficiaries of this. Okay, let me summarize then by just saying one of the questions I would encourage you to begin to think about 5 years ago, as I said, 4 years ago, I really had no idea. I wanted to do something. I had no idea of what. And now we've gotten into housing. We've gotten into stoves. We've gotten into building bridges. And as Stan will be sharing in a minute, we've been doing neat stuff with coconuts. And I'm finding there are so many exciting areas of opportunity that if you'll pray and ask God to guide and direct you, He will help you to identify neat areas to work in. He'll help you to find really great partners, which is, I think, a key part of this. You can't work in a developing country without a good partner. And take the opportunity to go on a mission trip to some of these places and ask lots of questions. One of my heroes in doing this is a fellow named Paul Pollock. He's a psychiatrist, and he's helped 17 million families triple their income in the last 20 years, 17 million. And I asked him, how could you do that, Paul? You're not an engineer. You're not a business guy. You're a psychiatrist. And he said, my one training skill is listening. Okay? And he said, if you're going to be good at appropriate technology, the single most important thing to do is to know how to go and ask questions and listen and learn what the people need and what they would actually use. And then working with them, help to develop that. He did this with basically drip irrigation systems. And he's done remarkable work listening. He's interviewed personally over 3,200 poor farmers. And trust me, he knows almost everything there is to know about what farmers will want, what they will use, what they're willing to pay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Second question there, the second thing I would encourage you to do is to say it's, if it is a journey that you should begin, do so by praying and asking God to guide and direct you again into the right areas, into the right partnerships. Why don't we stop here? We're out of time. And maybe we can take just a couple of questions, Stanton. But I think there are lots of neat things that you can do. And a lot of you don't have to have, a lot of this is sort of people in chemistry and physics and other areas as well as engineering. A lot of the problems we're talking about are not that complex. that you necessarily have to have a degree in engineering to work on some of these. A lot of you could do that. There's some wonderful organizations. If you're interested, I can get you more websites of people you can also partner with. Yes, Chuck? You absolutely are, and the website is www.lazarianworldhomes, either .com or .org, I'm not sure which, or maybe both, Lazarian World Homes. They have all the technical information, they have floor plan designs, they have all the specs. We actually did the design of the blocks here at Baylor. They will provide those, and it's easy to get molds made. The only cost in setting up a business someplace would be $30,000 for the molds to make the pieces, and then have somebody in country who already does expandable polystyrene. Yeah. You know, most of that bridge was built in Kenya. Okay. Almost all of the pieces for it came from India, partly because it's closer and partly because it was cheaper. Now, we had to make some hard choices. Sometimes when you buy, for example, cable from India, you can either get cable that's strength tested or you can get it galvanized so it doesn't corrode. But it's hard to find both. So sometimes you have to sort of say, well, you know, we'll have to make some choices. Engineering judgment, exactly right. But I think, I would guess, now I'm not sure about the grading for the deck. We were trying to get that donated from a company in the United States that's actually owned by a Christian. And I don't know what Harmon, what he finally did on that. Because he was taking care of a lot of the purchasing. We helped with some of the design stuff. He invited us to come and help with the building, but it just didn't work out at the time he was doing that. I was kind of busy with other things. Someday I hope to get back to Kenya, though, and I want to go walk on that bridge and say, gosh, we helped to design this. And let me tell you, your students get really excited when they work on projects like that and realize how many people are going to be benefiting. Okay.